Tracy Jane and Through My Teeth. Right here on Radio 3. So, Morris, what a pleasure to see you in the flesh, not an AI.
It is a pleasure to be seen in the flesh.
Passing through Hong Kong. I hope you enjoy. I know you've got a couple of days here. Is there anything you particularly want to do?
Sleep.
Fair enough, you must be.
But I do want to see you around. I've not been in Hong Kong. I think it's about 7 or 8 years since I've been here last.
Yeah. Interesting. So just eat and sleep. I mean, all this travelling. I mean, I believe you were caught up in the hoo-ha with not being able to get where you needed to go, like squillions of other people.
Yeah, we were. So I love Hong Kong to death, but we didn't intend to be here on this trip. We actually were meant to go through Dubai, and we managed to get out of Australia through Dubai, and we ended up in Europe. That's where our travels took us.
Yeah.
And, of course, we thought our tickets would take us home the same way, but woke up one morning to find a note from my travel agent saying that the plane no longer thought it was a good thing to fly. And literally cancelled the flight and all flights.
So fix it for you because she's a star.
Well, she did. And that was the other end of the email. We must find good people around us. Well, we must.
Yeah.
Because I woke up and the email said, don't read your other emails. I fixed it for you. And we came back on wonderful Cathay. So we're now flying through Cathay and, of course, are doing Hong Kong.
Yeah, well, good on you. I mean, even just talking about this, it must have well done for getting it sorted and everything. But we talk about various businesses and industries in our weekly chats, the future of, and everybody thinks, I mean, we all do. We think as soon as there's something goes wrong with an airline pattern or whatever, you know, a magic wand can be waved and it all gets fixed. Well, as you and many others know, that isn't the case. I mean, it's Jenga, isn't it, actually?
It is. And it's amazing when you pull one thread out, how the tapestry just unfolds, because it's not as easy as putting on a flight. I mean, I know that I was affected by it and I didn't like it and it cost me a lot of money to get around it.
One piece,
but I totally accept why it happened because the airline just has to do what the airline has to do to make sure it's safe and to fly and to get people backwards and forwards. And we can talk about gouging and the rest of it, and yes, I will, but they do what they have to do.
Yeah.
And I think it'll take at least 3 or 4 months to solve this, because I know firsthand from working in and around the industry, you can't just put a plane in the sky. It sounds easy.
No, it doesn't, but it sounds really precarious. That's what I'm getting at.
I mean, you can take a car out of the garage and drive somewhere you didn't think to, but there's so much involved in actually putting a plane into the sky. Mm. It just can't be done.
Well, step one, you've talked about they don't want to put anybody in danger, et cetera, et cetera. That's triage. That's the top of the pyramid,
absolutely,
isn't it? But the interesting thing to me is we always chit-chat about AI stuff, and it's fascinating. It's just, will it ever go in a direction where they, how do I put it, they have more safety? The whole thing doesn't unfold when a couple of little pieces go spare.
I don't think we can.
I don't think so.
I honestly don't think we can, because what's happened here is what you and I talk about a lot, and that's horrible humans. I mean, it doesn't matter who and where and what the sides are. What's happening is that there are conflicts, there are human conflicts around the world, and for whatever reason, we just can't safely fly over it.
So the airlines are cool. Their systems are cool. They're just disrupted.
I totally believe they are, and I know for a first-hand fact that artificial intelligence has been in the airline industry for longer than you and I have talked about it, and longer than most, because it monitors planes in the sky. It monitors their well-being. It knows where they are and when they are and how to fly.
It does all of
that anyway. This is just simply they cannot put it in that airspace at that time. And also, of course, the fuel and everything else goes with it.
Okay, we talk about AI in a certain way these days, but going way, way back, I mean, I'm sure Alan Turing had some kind of germ of an idea that led to this, that led to the other. But you say airlines have been using AI for a while. What would their very, very basic version of it might have been?
I can tell you how they've been using it for a long time. It's not so much the airlines, it's the aeroplanes themselves.
Oh, okay.
One of the things that we take for granted, or that we don't really know and perhaps shouldn't know, is that most of the engines on most of the aeroplanes around the world are actually not owned by the airlines. They're owned by people like Rolls-Royce.
They own them.
Well, they own or they lease them.
Right.
So they are responsible for those engines, and they track them in real time 24/7. So every engine that is in the sky is literally being tracked by humans and by artificial intelligence. And it knows how that motor is operating in the sky.
So it's another layer of safety.
It's another layer of safety, absolutely, because they are responsible. Not that we ever, ever, ever want to fall out of the sky, but they have to know what's happened to that motor. So that's something that's been around for years and years. It's truly incredible. They have a call centre, which I've been in.
Oh, yeah.
A call centre. I've been in the Rolls-Royce one, I should say. They have a call centre there with people, and they use all sorts of really incredible technology because, of course, They don't sit there, humans watching every airline, every motor.
Yeah.
And when something is untoward, it notifies them, the airline, the pilot and everybody else. And, of course, we hope that happens and don't believe it happens very often.
It's kind of funny that they're monitoring a component, not the whole thing.
Well, that's true. But lots of other people monitor the whole thing. So really what they're monitoring is the health and well-being of the engine, making sure that it's able to keep people up there. We have great people who are doing, of course, all the usual tracking, who are making sure planes are in the sky, no other planes around them. There's lots of tracking going on.
Have you noticed that these days we're not going on about AI? We're talking about a thing. Oh, and there's an AI component. Of course there is.
Yeah.
So it's become quite normal now, hasn't it?
Thankfully. Thankfully, we're over the hysteria. It's very much like electricity and gas. It's just there.
It's just there.
I mean, it's a bit scary. It's a bit possible. You know, it's a bit of all those things because we're going to take a couple of years for it to make sense till it really gets ordinary every day. But I think you're absolutely right. For most people, it just is. How do we use it? And do we use it at all?
What were we talking about the other week when you made some crack about, yeah, they did the same with electricity and the wheel and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You were basically saying that whenever something that's really paradigm comes out or gets discovered, there were always people who, through fear and confusion, won't like it. Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is. It's a thing through human history. We have it exactly when we had electricity and gas, using that analogy again. If you go back into the newspapers of the day, there are wonderful articles in the New York Times that talk about preachers from the pulpit who literally said, if you have electricity and gas in your home, you are inviting the devil into your home. Do not do it. And it was the same with cars. Can you imagine all those horseless carriages running around and people getting excited by them?
When you have the evangelists doing this kind of thing, I mean, the two questions are, do you think they're doing it with some agenda, or do you think they're genuinely scared of this stuff?
I think they're genuinely scared. I mean, some are doing it with an agenda, but I think most are scared, and we've talked about that many times, you know, that past fear, future traumas type thing.
Yeah.
They just don't know what to do with it, and it's easy enough to crouch it in some kind of evil terms of past history. And the people that they are speaking to are also looking for guidance, so they accept it really easily. If you tell me it's a devil incarnate, and you are supposed to know more than me, I'm going to accept it.
You know, to this day, people, it's a human thing, obviously. To this day, people do stuff like, do you remember some of the hokey pokey stuff that came out around COVID?
Yes.
I mean, before people really got their heads around it, I'm assuming also it was the same in the 90s with AIDS and HIV.
Yes, and microwaves.
And microwaves. That was it.
All of those technologies, again, caused great consternation to people who really didn't understand it. Yes, there are issues with microwaves. Yes, COVID had issues and all of that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as deep and dark and horrible as some people made out.
People rebel against this kind of thing. I mean, I mentioned the 90s and HIV, the gay plague.
Oh,
it was called, wasn't it? So that wasn't just saying I don't understand this. That was me fighting against this plague.
Yes.
That's crazy that in this day and age we're still doing medieval stuff.
Yes. And for some people, being able to hold another group of people up to shame and ridicule as they wanted to before this, but now had they believed something to hang them with.
So now I'm assuming with all the cool AI inventions and discoveries coming up, people are still acting the same. It's almost like there's a hidden part of human beings that if you push here, we revert.
Yeah. Physiologically, we're hardwired to resist these things.
Is that so?
I think so. I think it's been
so
proven.
Why have you got a job?
I've got a job because it's my role to make people not resist it as much as possible, to make it palatable and easy, I hope.
Is it very hard? Who is it the hardest for you to convince? Because you talk to me a lot about corporates. And I can imagine sort of people of our parents' generation going, oh, no, we don't do that because they just don't want to deal. A corporate's the hardest.
It really depends. I think it's a human factor again. It depends on what the conversation's about. I find people of an age who have been in the industry, who have been in their job for a while, who may have reached through the ranks or whatever else, who are basically used to doing it some way, really resist it because it doesn't make sense to them. They also see a finality to their work, not to their life, but to their work. They may be reaching retirement. But the other end is...
There are other angles, aren't there?
There are, because the other end is the juniors. I mean, those coming into their careers. Last night, my wife and I were having dinner, and we were sat at a table with two wonderful young gentlemen. Just by total serendipity accident.
Yeah.
Because there was only one table of four and we decided we would share it. I bent their ear. I must say I felt sorry for them after an ear. I think it was bleeding. But it turned out that they were engineers from America.
I knew you were going to say that.
Two young people from America, both of them in IT.
Great.
And we had this wonderful conversation with my wife rolling her eyes next to us because the three of us were nattering on like long-lost friends. But the point was that they were in their 20s, early in their career, doing incredible, wonderful things around security and other spaces, one New York, one Seattle. And I spent about an hour of my time trying to convince them that the world was not evil. And they work with artificial intelligence. They work, between them, they worked for most, for all of the big four tech companies. And they were convinced, I think still are, that AI was not as wonderful, even though they use it, as I think it could be.
They are tech guys who understand this stuff. Were they just coming at you with a combative, let's have a chat angle?
No. One of them, and we actually talked about that, one of them is very much in the defense security space.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah, so most of the people he speaks to, and we unpack that because you've gathered already, I like to unpack those conversations.
So travels to Hong Kong, didn't mean to be here, bends the ear of some rocket scientists.
Seventh floor up in a vegetarian restaurant.
And
he could see at the end that because he'd worked in this, works in this defence space and works in security, his entire life is about negativity. It is about making sure that AI doesn't escape and all the terrible things that could happen because of it.
Yeah.
And he spends very little time, because it really is not where he needs to be, wondering about the wonders of what it actually could do really well.
Sure. But they, I mean, people in that industry, they have to stress test things mentally and physically. So Doubting Thomas, he's got to be, hasn't he?
He does. For the work he does, I would not want him to be any other way.
Which age group? I don't want you to go down the Gen Avenue. Which age group, in your experience, is the most susceptible to change?
Again, I think it is about change. Big stuff. Look, I find the young'uns take it really well. Young'uns is really anybody younger than me. But the teenagers and things, on a whole, accept the technology really easily. It's just part of their life. They're willing to discover, willing to find. I don't think they've, in fact, I know they're not very sophisticated at using it or understanding it or really finding its perils. But they're the most likely to want to use it. The other side is the thing we talk about a lot too, the selfish gene. You know, if something comes out and it really tickles our fancy, it does something well for us, it advances us, makes life easier, it tends to be when we'll accept it more.
Another thing I always find to chuck into that is when people are actually inspired. They're genuinely, wow, this is great. They're from, you know, in a visceral level, they're inspired. Then they tend to go down that avenue.
And again, not for a negative, but the word selfish comes in. And that's a good thing. It's not a negative word. Exactly that. If there's a purpose in our lives that we can see for it, then of course we're going to take more interest in it.
So by process of elimination, I'm coming to the fact that perhaps baby boomers are the least susceptible to change.
Usually.
Is it? Is that
usually
true?
I find usually. Yeah. So I'm often brought in at board level.
Post-war babies, basically. Yeah.
I'm often brought in at board level to try and convince people of my vintage, that the world is not falling apart, that they need to make changes because the legacy they leave behind otherwise will not be great. You know, if they don't allow AI in to some extent, if they don't make changes to some extent.
What about those that don't care and they're just like,
oh, they're difficult.
I'm going to work and I'm going home, see you later?
It's difficult to put people into a category, but those closer to retirement or close to leaving the workforce are usually those types of people. And it's one of the things that I mentally look for. If I find somebody who's jaded, doesn't want to change, I kind of try and figure out how far away they are from retirement or from whatever they want to achieve in life. The closer they are to that, the less likely they are to want to change. Why would I want to change things when things are okay or working now?
This is fascinating. So what I'm getting again is that it's not about AI. Really is about us. I don't like this. I do like that. I'm miserable. So it's not about the product, is it?
I'm never getting a mobile phone. I'm never getting a PC. I'm never using the internet. You and I have heard all those things through the years. It's exactly the same chant. I'm never using AI. But eventually most people do because they find purpose in it. Those that don't see the purpose in it just won't, and they'll keep rallying against it. And that's fine because we live in a world of continuum. Lots of colours, lots of flavours. We should not all do anything. Mm. We should choose what it is that we want to do. But the caveat to that is we shouldn't impact on others not choosing the same course if they don't wish to.
Gosh, then that's the whole conversation when you have mates or you know people, somebody's a Christian, somebody's Jewish, somebody's this, somebody's blah, 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 blah. And I think what you learn as you get a little bit older is don't try and tell them they shouldn't do this. Just hang out, basically. But the quid pro quo is they shouldn't tell you either.
Exactly. Live your life and let others do the same.
Absolutely. At this stage of our conversations, I usually say look at Morris's website, morrisfuturist.com, because he's put some cool things on his blog. You probably haven't had much time to do that, but has anything inspired you on your tour?
There actually are blogs, Pace. There actually are. I pre-did them before I left, so you can still go and find new stuff.
But I mean, have you suddenly discovered something on your trip and you think, oh, I must look into this?
Not so much look into it, but on a really personal level, we were chatting about it before. We talked about artificial intelligence a lot, and we talk about it a lot over the weeks and months. I've spent the last 2.5 weeks with the folks, with the family. Yeah. Not the folks, have gone with the family, touring around Poland specifically, because as you get by the end of the surname, that's where our family heralds from. My big sister and I took 12 people. We started off with four, and the rest of the family decided they were coming along from all over the world. We took them to the homestead. We took them back to Poland, being my children, and we even had a grandchild. My sister's grandchild came with also, touring around where the folks had been, folks, grandparents, great-grandparents, showing them the streets and the schools and the other things they went to. I'm getting to the point of AI. One of the people that came along at very last minute, literally with about a week's notice, was my sister, my big sister's granddaughter, who happens to be 18 and doing a gap year.
Right.
She came with, and I was not sure that she would kind of want to hang out with all these family people. You get an 18-year-old really doesn't want to be with a whole lot of family. She was joyous and wonderful, as she always is. But to your point, we were sitting there, we were watching, we were walking through streets, looking at buildings, doing all kinds of things. We stopped at a family homestead, which is the way I call an old family home that we had the address to.
Yeah.
And it had changed since I'd been there last, which is 12 years ago.
Mm.
And my sister and I, who came with me last time, were looking at the building and saying, it is that building, but it doesn't look like it used to. And she comes up to the front and brings out her mobile phone and says, here's a picture of it 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She went into Google Maps and had regressed 12 years into a map from 12 years ago.
That's worth knowing.
That
it does that.
And she said to us and showed everybody, well, this is what it looked like when you were here. This is what it looks like now because we're standing in front of it. This is the right address and here it is.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful because she was able to find that kind of insight. Also, family history, because it's difficult. There weren't physical records, a lot of them at the time.
Of course not.
Even in the short space of time that she was there, she was able, through this thing called ChatGPT and other things that she used, to pull out records and information and all kinds of things on the fly as we walked past stuff. It was fascinating to see that what had taken me most of my life to assemble, she could add to really quickly in the space of milliseconds by using this new technology.
And for somebody who wasn't terribly into it, that's incredible. That's the story about her little epiphany, if you like.
It was, and she felt so included, not that she wouldn't have anyway, because she could add these wonderful new gems to it and find things really easily and quickly. It was wonderful to see that. So all of that worked really, really well.
What was the reaction of the older people, versus the real young'uns in it? This feeling that you get when you see something that you know it's part of you, but you don't know why.
Yeah. I don't know. I actually want to go back because it's too soon. It's the question I asked all the way along.
Yeah.
Because my sister and I grew up with our parents, obviously. We lived with them. So for us, these things were more visceral. They were things they talked about even if they didn't, in daily conversation, bits and pieces.
Grandparents stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the younger ones had not. So I'm really fascinated to see when I get back how much they took in. But I must say my nephews and nieces, who are much older genealogically than I see them in my mind, I still see them as very young children. They have children of their own. We're enamored with it and actually took on the conversation really well. We're engaged with it.
Awesome.
It was wonderful to see. I mean, they self-selected themselves to come, obviously. Yeah. It was a big trip from Oz for everyone to get there.
Massive, actually.
Oh, it was. And for 12 people to turn up at the same spot, again, through all the turmoil of airlines, because everybody was affected by it. Nobody dropped out. Everybody decided they were coming. And the wonderfulness for me, I'm sure, is that we, my sister and I, were able to pass on family history in a really physical way, not just talk about it, but actually show it.
Just before we say goodbye for the next 8 years, when you think about your family history, the homestead, Poland, do you mentally fixate on a particular era?
Yeah, we do, because we are post-World War II. We're refugees.
Right.
And that's one of the things I said to the family over and over again, because you can imagine I lecture them like I lecture everybody else. It is what I do, unfortunately, and I realise it. And I apologise to them, but they know me well enough. I said to them that we spent a lot of time thinking about a particular moment in time, which was what caused them to leave Europe and come to Australia. And what we were able to do and what I was able to do when I went there the first time with my big sis is really focus more on their lives. And that was wonderful, to actually see them as live human beings, see them where they went to school, the streets they walked in, literally the parks they played in. My mother, who is long gone, has a wonderful girlfriend who is also long gone, who I consider my auntie. We found her home and we were able to walk between the two homes to think about the streets that the two of them must have gone down when they were teenagers.
Yeah.
All that wonderfulness of actually seeing them alive was the joy of doing this trip.
So all in all, even this bit, it's been quite a winner for you, really, hasn't it?
It has. I mean,
despite all the serendipity, that's the word.
It has. And of course, the top offer is being live with you.
Yeah, whatever. Morris, absolute pleasure to have you in the studio. We will catch up in a couple of weeks.
We shall.
We shall catch up in a couple of weeks. Anything you want to bring our listeners to that's actually on your blog before we say goodbye today?
There's a whole new stuff that I've written on leadership and what it means and how I might work in our lives. I think it's really good stuff, but I'm biased anyway. It's morrisfuturist.com.
Take care. See ya.